It's Sunday, November 20th, 2016. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Well, good evening and welcome to another podcast for moving at the speed of creativity for this month. It has really been a whirlwind the last few weeks, and gosh, especially last week, I realized I was on YouTube Live 4 times last week, and a podcast one other time, or not a podcast, I guess, just another video conference. So five times being on some kind of live video stream, and I'm excited in this session to be able to share two recordings. One is going to be the first one from the Google Summit that took place in Mays, Kansas, which is just northwest of Wichita, Kansas, 2 weeks ago on Saturday, November the 12th. And I had an opportunity to head up there and share the opening session and then a couple breakout sessions. I also published those last weekend on my Fuel for Educational Change Agents, and I'll include those links in the podcast show notes, but you can go to audio.speedofcreativity.org and you can check those out. I had a session on quick edit videography and also a session on geomaps using a Google form which connects to a map and shares the contents of your form on each place mark on your map, which is kind of cool. So the second recording that I'll share is from this weekend on Saturday, November the 19th, up in Enid, Oklahoma, which is about an hour and a half north-northwest of Oklahoma City. And Enid, and specifically Waller Middle School, hosted a TEDx event. And this was their second year to host a TEDx youth event. There are only 19 TEDx youth events in the United States this year, and one of them is right here in Oklahoma in Enid. So I was remembering back to when my friend Bob Sprankle took his daughter Zoe up to Redmond, Washington for TEDx Redmond, which was, I think, one of the first, if not the first, TEDx youth events, and just the excitement around that, and it really was awesome. And definitely the highlight for me was being able to help my daughter Rachel prepare a presentation, and we'll be looking forward to the recordings of these videos that were professionally recorded by the students at Waller Middle School, published on YouTube from to the TEDx website. But I did take an audio recorder and just kind of left it in the audience for this session. They did 3 different sessions of about five or six different sessions apiece. And in addition to having student presenters, they had one adult presenter for each of the sessions. And they also shared a TEDx, or actually a TED video from another event in each one. So it was awesome. You know, if you have ever watched a TED video, which I hope you have, because they're some of the highest quality videos about engaging ideas that you will find anywhere. You know that their format is really engaging, really encourages people to just jump right into a story and, you know, use visual images in compelling ways. Rachel's presentation was called Tales from a Teenage Minecraft YouTuber, and she just did a great job sharing about some of her lessons learned and some of her experiences over the past 2 years being on YouTube. If you're interested in checking out her YouTube channel, you can find her by Googling Rachel Artist on YouTube, and you will find it. She also has a website, rachelfryer.com, that has a link to her YouTube channel, but she hasn't posted anything directly on the site recently, but she's posting videos a lot, and she is RachFMC on Twitter. I will say that I think my number one hope for her sharing this TEDx talk is that, you know, she doesn't basically face, you know, trolls and really ugliness online. There's been just very, very little of that. There's been some, but very little of that that she has encountered. And I think that sometimes when people get the spotlight from mainstream media, you know, there can be some really ugly things that can happen as they get attention from people that want to, you know, be nasty and mean. So of course, I really hope that doesn't happen to Rachel and hope that it's positive, you know, that it's a good opportunity for her to amplify her ideas. And what she really wanted to share was how positive YouTube can be, and that sometimes we hear a lot of negative about social media and YouTube specifically. And, you know, she has friends literally around the world now that she has played Minecraft with on servers and watches their videos, and, you know, they interact via Twitter and Instagram. One of the things that she didn't say specifically in the presentation, but that's important, is, you know, that together we've really navigated a lot of this. You know, how do you know this person's really a kid? You know, is this going to be safe? You know, and checking out people's profiles and being able to, you know, essentially use the social media channels for transparency to see, you know, is this really the person that it purports to be? And so anyway, it was great. So, to recap, and I'll include some links in the show notes, I've got to get permission and see if we can share this, but on Tuesday of last week, Matt Scully, who is at Providence Day School in Raleigh, North Carolina, video conference with our digital citizenship team at school, and just shared a great interactive presentation about their journey with digital citizenship. I'm hopeful that I'll be able to share that, but I actually need to get permission from Matt and talk with him this week. But that was video conference one from last week. Then on Tuesday, I had a chance to be interviewed and be on YouTube Live. Oops, and it starts to play. With Derek Rodenizer, and he is up in Ontario, and I just kind of met him on Twitter and had checked out his podcast, and he said, hey, you want to come on the show? And we had really an unscripted hour-long conversation about education, technology, relationships, professional development, and a bunch of things. So I will include that link in the show notes because that is available on SoundCloud, and you can subscribe with iTunes. On Wednesday, I have the EdTech Situation Room, and my co-host, Jason Neifer, was out on assignment. So Jen Carey, who is a director of technology down in Miami, Florida, came on the show, and we had a great conversation. Really, really enjoyed it. And some of what we touched on was a preparation for Saturday because we talked about surveillance and privacy and digital citizenship. Then Thursday, I was behind the scenes for the second live panel discussion for the K-12 online conference. And the second strand that kicked off last week is keynoted by David Jakes, and David and an all-star panel of wonderful folks from around the world, again, talked about learning spaces, and that was just fantastic. And so I'll include a link in that in the show notes for that as well. And then the last time on YouTube Live was Saturday because the TEDx event in Enid, Oklahoma at Waller Middle School was broadcast live on the internet, and my mom was actually able to see my presentation live, and that was pretty cool. So that is the lineup. I'm looking forward to celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States with our family and my parents and sister's family, and just having some time off. And so I'm actually not positive on the EdTech Situation Room for Wednesday. We may end up taking this week off for the holiday, or we may be on, but I'm definitely not going to be doing four or five video conferences this week, and that is definitely a record for me. So I guess it kind of shows the ways in which interactive video and YouTube Live specifically are becoming more normalized in our lives, which is a good thing on the whole. But looking forward to a vacation and a holiday. And if you're in the United States celebrating Thanksgiving, I hope you will have a wonderful break and restful holiday as well with family. And so without further ado, here we go back to Mays, Kansas on November 12th. And then we'll be heading over to Enid, Oklahoma for a TEDx presentation. And I'll say that in both these presentations, the Google Summit in Mays, I thought I had a little less time than I ended up having. So my comments were a little abbreviated, but I'll include a link to my slides that I shared in both cases. And I had a little bit of a slide glitch in the TEDx session and ended up, you know, just a few slides at the end that I had to skip. But without further ado, here we go. Mays, Kansas, November 12th, 2016.
It's a pleasure to be with you today from Oklahoma City. I am as much as an Air Force brat can be, originally from Manhattan. My parents still live there. I graduated from Manhattan High in 88, if you really want to know how old I am. Just took the trek across Kansas on I-70 last weekend. Our oldest son just became a freshman in college, and so it was Parents Weekend at Colorado School of Mines, and we think he is doing well. He talked very little when he lived with us, and even less now that he's in college. So anyway, I am the director of technology now at the Cassidy School. We have about 900 students, pre-K through 12, about 170 teachers. Prior to that, I was teaching STEM full-time to fourth and fifth graders in Yukon, Oklahoma, in an iPad classroom. And I've done a variety of sundry things. But I don't really want to talk about myself. I want to talk about, for 12 minutes or so, some googly ideas. And so if you'd like to access these slides, which are available as a Google slideshow, you can scan that QR code that I'll put up at the end again, or just go to the shortened link, wfryer.me/November12, all lowercase. You can also just go to my Twitter ID, which is wfryer, and the pinned tweet there at the top is the link to these slides. So in 1972, I was 2 years old. Our family lived in Colorado Springs, and my dad had just become an instructor at the Air Force Academy in the math department. And in 1972, the math department was having a debate because they had been issuing something called slide rules to every cadet at the academy since, I would say, time immemorial, but the academy actually started fairly recently. The first class was in 59. So in 54, they were in Denver, and I think everyone's had a slide rule, you know, from 54 to 72. So there were lots of meetings, there were, you know, debates, because what had come about in 72? The first scientific calculator. And so there were groups that tested this and, you know, weighed the impact and would this be preparing the engineers? Because at that time at the academy, you didn't really have a choice. It was engineering or engineering. That's just what everybody did. What did they decide? Calculator? Slide rule.
Slide rule.
Yeah. They stuck with the slide rule. So fast forward to today in 2016. How many of you have bought one of these new Google products? You're aware of Made with Google. So go to madeby.google.com, and not only can you get Chromecasts and get VR headsets, but you can get a Pixel, which of course runs Android, of course, Google's operating system, which I'll say I have my feet in both worlds. I love Apple stuff, and I have my iPhone and my MacBook, but gosh, as a tech director especially, I just love Chrome. There's nothing easier to manage in a school than Chrome. And I have about 85 iPads under management and 11 carts of Chromebooks under management. And so I've got a pretty good understanding of what goes into both. But how about this guy on the left side? What is that little disc thing that looks like two hockey pucks over there?
Chromecast.
Okay, the Chromecast is the black one. What about the white thing that's over there on the side? The new home router that Google has, right, that you can control with your app on the phone, which you can... What does quality of service look like at your house when you need to do a Google Hangout? Do you have anybody who streams Netflix at your home? We have the plan where you can stream like four streams, and my son's gone, so there's one gone. But quality services are, everyone off Netflix! Dad's gonna hang out. You know, but this one has the ability to actually manage that. And how about this thing that's to the left of the Pixel? Do you know what that is? That's on the far side, virtual reality headset. Just to the left of Pixel. Google Home. The Google Assistant. Google had a large event in October and made some big announcements, which those of us that have been Google App Schools are now using the Google G Suite, right? The Google Suite. Walt Mossberg, who writes tech stuff and is a really great person to follow, said that Google's hardware is a vessel for AI. On Wednesday night's web show that I do with my friend Jason up in Montana, he demonstrated one of these. And listen to what Sundar Pichai said about this. He called AI, artificial intelligence, a seminal moment in computing on a par with the personal computer, the web, and the smartphone going mainstream at roughly 10-year intervals. It's clear to me that we are moving from a mobile first to an AI first world. Now, how many of you have seen a movie about artificial intelligence that got you a little scared? Right? Terminator, RoboCop. Stephen Levy, who's another great person to follow, wrote this in Back Channel on October 25th. The Google Assistant needs you. Do you remember when Google had their 411 service and you'd call in to get your Yellow Pages or whatever like that? Why was Google doing that for free when AT&T was charging money for that?
Gathering information.
They were gathering information. They were gathering what kind of information?
Personal,
your voice, right? Speech to text. They gathered tons of audio recordings, and so they were able to then improve speech to text to the point where today, in November of 2016, we can purchase this device and say, okay, Google, you know, and not quite have a conversation. Have any of your kids tried to have a conversation with Siri? All right, and they want to have a multiple-step conversation, right? Not just, what's the weather today, Siri? You know, we're not quite there. But what Levy says in the article is that you will view this as a failure as we get started, but Google sees it as an opportunity. It's part of the transition. The transition to having artificial intelligence all around us. Okay, Jen, did you find your phone yet? How do you feel without that phone, Jen? Feel a little naked, right? It's become an appendage, right? If you don't have your device, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm at my lifeline. You know, how am I going to be connected to my significant other or my kids or, you know? Yeah, and I've seen some people, you know, consoling. All right, so we are linear people living in a time of exponential change. My grandmother was born in 1903. What happened in 1903 at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina? Couple bicycle guys got a plane going, right? And in her lifetime, from 1903 till the early 90s, when she passed away, she was from Powell, Wyoming, or lived in Powell. She was actually from Nebraska, from Scotts Bluffs, where she was born. But my dad liked to say, look at what she saw in her life. From horse and buggy, dawn of aviation, to land on the moon, to space shuttle. But I'm really getting the feeling that what we're experiencing in our lives, is gonna make what she experienced in pretty much the 20th century look like small change. It's hard to be in the elbow of a vertical, of what's called an asymptotic line, right? For those math folks, you know, of a line that's going vertical. And the changes that are happening are like that. So, this is kinda cool. Have you seen Google Maps? Street View Player. Saw this on Twitter from Scott McLeod this week. You put in your two locations. I put in Sedgwick County Zoo and Mays, Kansas. And what it's going to load up here is it's going to take all the Street View images and give us a virtual field trip between those points. So how many of you have used Google Street View? You've taken that little peg man, is that what he's called, the yellow guy, and you drag it down. And isn't it amazing, I'll do a session on GeoMaps later this morning, how what used to be Google Earth and have to require this big software app now runs in the browser, right? And so much of that capability is available. But is anybody creeped out by this at all? But there's also good connections to make, right? If we're going to want students to think about measurement, doing an activity where we have students take a challenge, okay? Where's your house? Where's our school? You know, how many meters is that? How many centimeters is that? How many kilometers is that? Being able to do things in context. So, what do we do? Now, I'll say this before I give you my next answer. At most Google events I've been to, and I'm not sure that this is the right answer, it seems to be, let's drink out of the fire hose. Maybe you feel like that right now. You're like, Wes, slow the heck down. You're talking too fast. And I had a chance to do the Google Certified Teacher Program in 2013. And that program, which has been changed and altered, you had to go to a Google campus. I've been to Mountain View, but I haven't done an institute there. But it really felt like drinking from the fire hose, which can be exciting. But what happens as you drink from the fire hose of information? You fill up, right? And you start to become overwhelmed. In fact, if we could do a virtual reality thing right now, and I'd love this for any class that I teach, I'd love to see how overwhelmed people are feeling right at that moment, right? Because you may have had a heck of a lot of things happen to you before you got here today that put you at 9 out of 10, you know, and things can push you further over the edge. That's probably the easiest thing to do, is to be overwhelmed. My encouragement for us today is to really hone in on one thing, okay? There's so much that Google offers in the universe, in their universe of tools. We're all at different places with our use of the tools. And so it's very easy to be overwhelmed. Try and key in on just one or two small things. I think the best thing we can do is be connected. I'm so excited you're doing this in Kansas. I want this in Oklahoma, okay? Because we've got, as you do, you're way ahead of us in many respects. But we've got many schools going to Chromebooks and utilizing Google. I do a show on Wednesday nights with my friend Jason, who's up in Montana, on YouTube Live. And those are archived. We did our 28th show this week. That's one way to stay in touch. But I don't know if I can get through these in 3 minutes. But I may not just elaborate. Here's 6 googly things you can do right now. All right. And let's just start with an extension. How many of you use Tab Suspender? Really? This is my absolute number one favorite extension. Why? Because the more tabs you open in Chrome, what does that do to your computer? It slows it down. It takes memory. And so Tab Suspender, if you've been inactive in a tab, just suspends it. Now be careful. If you've typed in some stuff, like you were filling out a form, this won't be your friend because you could lose it. So you might, you know, not go away from that tab or type it something else if it's an essay. But Tab Suspender absolutely is my number one favorite extension. And whatever amount of RAM memory you have on your computer, it's going to make it faster. Number two, how many of you filter search results by date? That's something that you do. Let's teach our kids and our teachers to do this, right? Go to a Google search. This is the basics of Google, right? Google 101 is, let's search better. Let's fill, because it's not an issue of accessing information today. It's about filtering it. Can I filter the flood and get relevant stuff that I could trust and all this? So when you go up to Google search results now and click tools, you can go to any time. And in this case, I scrolled back to the past year because I wanted to get studies or research or infographics that had to do with the power of images, but I didn't want something from 2013. I wanted something in the last year. So that filtering is a really good thing. And this is what I found. This came from a Cisco white paper called Cisco VNI Forecast and Methodology 2015 to 2020. Said that 79% of internet traffic will be video content by 2018. Is your school biased towards text? I read about a school this last week that has a no tech Wednesday. Okay? Now my school is actually very traditional. And this is an interesting thing about independent schools. And I've had a chance to go internationally to China and some other places too, to international schools. They're very good at preparing students traditionally to go to these Ivy League selective schools, right? So when you say, let's change, that can be, wait a minute, why do we need to change? We've been very successful. Here's the thing. How many of you have kids in your room who have an interest level for reading that's higher than their instructional level? Okay, my wife teaches third and fourth grade at Positive Tomorrows. It's a school for homeless kids in Oklahoma City downtown. And she's got kiddos from kindergarten, first grade reading level to fifth or sixth. They're iPad 1-to-1. If you tell them during gear time, this is a no technology time, do you know what you've just done? You've just condemned these kids who might read by themselves independently at a kindergarten level to reading the Spot and Jane books instead of reading the Goosebumps books or the scary stuff or, you know, whatever they're interested in. So, just a thought. I believe we're all steeped in a educational culture that tends to value text above all else. And I personally am now consuming more long-form books with Audible than I am sitting there reading my book. Can I read that book? Yes, I can. But I can listen to this when I'm driving up to Mays, Kansas, or when I'm commuting to work, etc. So, shared YouTube channel. You can quote me on this. Video is the pencil of the 21st century. Every single teacher needs to have a space to publish and share video. Why? Because there's so much we can express with video. And so one of the things we did last year, and I'm going to be working to encourage more publishing on it this year, is we set up a shared YouTube channel, right? Because just like a Google Doc, you can share a YouTube channel. And so Spanish teachers have posted some of the Spanish One projects that their kids did using Book Creator on iPad with country studies. And our meteorology teacher, I've got to publish on here, had some kids doing the weather with green screen. Okay, but he wasn't ready for his own channel. That's all right. We have a shared channel. I think that's a really good thing to do. Help your teachers graduate to an individual classroom YouTube channel. It can be scary. If I've never published video before, is there bad content on YouTube? Can there be problems when kids access stuff? You know, comments? Yes, all kinds of stuff. Is there good stuff on YouTube? There's incredible stuff on YouTube. You know, introducing kids to Khan Academy and showing them how they can individually progress through different levels of not only math, but science, I think, that's gigantic. So, classroom home-based website. How many of you have a public website where you share stuff? Please consider doing this. Who's doing the session on Google Sites today? Somebody is, right? Google Sites, yay! They just have done a bunch of updates to what they're offering. This is all the STEM curriculum for the 2 years I went back to the classroom after finishing my doctorate teaching fourth and fifth grade STEM. It's a Google site, stem.westfriar.com. Does it cost me anything to have that available and shared? Yeah, I have to pay $12 a year for my domain. Okay, westfriar.com costs me $12 a year. But Google provides the hosting for the site. I've found this to be true. Students rarely get energized by content published behind a password. And I love Google Classroom, and I think learning management systems are hugely valuable, right? Because if I've got however many kids I have in my class, how do you turn that into me? Is that an easy process or is that a hard process? It needs to be an easy process. So Google Classroom can make that very easy. But here's the thing. Who gets to see stuff published in your Google Classroom? Who gets to log into Google Classroom? Only users in your domain, although parents, I guess, can now be added. But it's a very limited number. So just think about this and consider it, that I have never had kids get so excited as when they have their stuff published on our classroom YouTube channel. All right, in 2 years, we published over 400 videos. Most of them are small. They're little STEM projects, Rube Goldberg projects, stop motion video. Kids got excited, and they showed their parents. I think that matters. You know, it matters when they share their learning. They're excited about it, and they're energized. This is my wife's website. Again, a Google site, classroom.shellyfriar.com. Go to her YouTube channel. Check out their radio show. This is our art teacher, elementary art teacher. She's seeing new shapes on Twitter, Megan Thompson. I just finished doing a 7-week after-school STEAM studio with her, which is a fun collaboration. And she's sharing what they're doing, right? Share that with your art teacher. There may be ideas there that they can share. So, new sites, we can learn about that today. You can customize the address, so it doesn't have to be this super long address. You can have a domain that goes with it. We started to do a learning showcase on Blogger, and I have not posted, but once on it this fall, that's one of my goals, is to showcase what our teachers are doing. Okay? We've got our librarian and one of our social studies teachers doing great stuff with 3D printing. In fact, last week, they're starting to do some 3D feather printing. Have you ever seen a 3D printed feather? You know, with the art teacher and the librarian. How cool! Is there anybody else that might be inspired by that? Sure. But what do we got to do? We got to share it. Okay, so consider using Blogger. You can do something called a CNAME change, and that way you don't have just a blogger.com/blah, blah, blah. You've got some word before your school domain. It's called a CNAME change, and you can use, your administrator can help you do that. So last shout out is to Easy Blogger Junior. Anybody use this? Best tool for especially primary level teachers to publish to YouTube and to Blogger. What this app does is it connects your Blogger account to your YouTube account, and it talks to the kids. Hi, what would you like to share today? Do you want to talk about a picture? And they can take a picture of their art, and they talk about their art, and then it publishes to the teacher's YouTube channel and the teacher's Blogger account as a draft post, which the teacher gets to approve. phenomenal. I'm in the third year of working with a group of pre-K teachers, seven pre-K teachers, eight now, in Stillwell, Oklahoma. Every kid has an iPad. It's iPad 1-to-1. Literacy 3. English literacy, digital literacy, Cherokee language literacy. And this is the app that the teachers have used to showcase what their kids are doing. So, last thing, I'm not going to go through this, but it's InfoPics. And pictures are a big deal, right? When you present, when you share, when you post, don't just post text. Don't just put a bunch of text up there on the screen. We've all had that teacher with the overhead projector, right? 12-point font, no modification, right? Just straight up, here's my printed Word file that I'm going to put up here for you to read. Use images, and so this isn't a Google tool, but it works on a Chromebook. It works on an iOS device. It is called Adobe SparkPost. So I'm going to skip the slides that explain how to do that and skip to the conclusion. 1972, the Air Force Academy stays with the slide rule. What happened eventually? Eventually, Wes went there in 1988, and I was the first class to be issued a desktop computer with a 3.5-inch floppy drive. When I graduated in 92, I got a 15-megabyte hard drive. Wow, I had to put that in myself. But technology marched on, and in the institution, in fact, our service academies were some of the first universities of higher learning to say we're all one-to-one. Okay, we're giving everybody a device. And that was a desktop, and eventually became a laptop. But they saw that in order to equip students to be successful in the future and to be powerful, we can't just rely upon yesterday's tools. And so thank you for being here. I'm excited to learn with you. And let's go innovate with Google tools. Thank you all very much.
Now I have the pleasure of introducing to you to Dr. Wesley Pryor with Digital Citizenship in the Surveillance State.
Like a growing number of folks around the world, I have a smartphone in my pocket. In fact, I have it in my pocket almost all the time. And until recently, I hadn't really thought a lot about these settings that I can find for privacy that allow me to control what apps have access to what parts of my phone, not only including the camera, but also including the microphone. About a month ago, I was in my kitchen on a Saturday morning, and I had a bag of Cheetos in my hand. And as I admittedly took probably more than would be very mannerful and good to do in public company and put it in my mouth, my phone popped up a message. And the message said, you should really avoid tempting foods at home because that can lead to binge eating. And I stopped cold in my tracks. What is going on? Yes, I have apps like Pacer and other things that track my steps and try to encourage me to be more healthy. But how would my phone know that I was eating Cheetos? Well, I have been reading a number of articles and seeing a number of videos and documentaries in the past couple months, and one of them is called If You're Not Paranoid, You're Crazy by Walter Kern. And one of the things that Kern says is that when we grant access to different apps and services and allow them to use our microphone, we don't always know when they are activating that device. And so upon getting that message in my kitchen on a Saturday, I promptly went to my privacy settings and turned off microphone access on my phone to Amazon, Facebook, and Google. And I felt a little bit less creeped out. But I actually have started to become increasingly aware of surveillance in our society, not only at a private level with Facebook and Google and Apple and companies like that, but also with our government. And I recently watched a Frontline documentary that was produced in May of 2014 called The United States of Secrets. And although I have heard about the Patriot Act, and I know that a lot of things after 9/11 changed in the United States with metadata and things that the government was tracking, I really had my eyes open to the incredible capabilities that not only governments, but also corporations and even individuals have to be able to open up our devices. In fact, one of the stories for this documentary I learned about is that it's now possible, and if you drive by certain U.S. military installations in our country, without you connecting to the wireless, without you attaching to Bluetooth or anything, devices can actually scan your phone, suck off all the information that they want, know exactly who you are, and identify whether or not they think you are a threat. In fact, in this article in Wired Magazine, it revealed that the National Security Agency is not only doing this to folks that might visit or drive by, let's say, a particular installation in the desert of Nevada, but also creating lists of people who are simply using privacy tools, like some of the ones I'm going to tell you about in this presentation. If you use Tor, if you use other kinds of privacy settings, there's a good chance that the document of information that the Department of Homeland Security has about you here in the United States is going to know that information, that you're trying to use these privacy tools. About a month ago, our family had a chance to go see this documentary, Edward Snowden. And while I had connected many dots about Snowden, this particular movie for my wife was a real revelation, because she had heard a little bit about this but didn't really understand what was Snowden doing when he was being a whistleblower. What were the things he was so upset about that caused him to completely give up his career and even his ability to live as a free citizen in the United States, and now he's still in hiding in Russia? What was up with that? Well, I think somewhere there is a line between paranoia and reasonable caution. And I think a little bit about Y2K, and I know some of you are probably too young to remember when we stepped into the 21st century, but there was a lot of paranoia about stepping into the 21st century and if computers were going to fail and what was going to happen. In fact, I remember my grandmother in Lubbock, Texas, would watch CNN all day long, and she would listen to this guy named Art Bell on the radio at night. And wow, did she ever get her brain filled with all kinds of terrible things that were going to happen the moment the clock struck 12 and we went into the 21st century. I do need to also say that everything I'm sharing with you is unclassified. I haven't had a security clearance with the government since 1994. And all of these things that I'm talking about are available for me and for you on the open web in documentaries and news articles and different kinds of sources. Because I really think we need to move a little bit closer to the paranoia side than we might be if we're simply sitting back and saying something like, you know, why should I care? Because I think we should all care. So today I'd like to talk about three faces of the surveillance state. And we've already touched on a couple of them. First off being the government. Second off being corporations. And third off being hackers, but I need to say black hat hackers. Because I'm actually going to be encouraging, especially the young people here in the audience and those that might watch online, to become hackers. But to become hackers for good and not for evil. Let's talk first about government surveillance. Mass surveillance is nothing new in the United States and the world. In fact, Wikipedia has some really good resources that you can dive into that can help you learn about the history of mass surveillance and many of the things that have been revealed by Snowden and others. But when the 9/11 attacks happened in New York City and the Twin Towers were taken down and we passed the Patriot Act in the United States, there were some big changes to the law, and there were also big changes to what government organizations started to do. Now, in this time, there's also been dramatic changes in technology. It wasn't that long ago that I did not have a phone in my pocket that I kept with me at all times, which, by the way, is connected to GPS, and for those people who can connect to it, can tell them where I am on the planet exactly, you know, within a few feet, I guess, at any time. So Snowden helped us understand some things I think that are very important. And I know that's a contentious topic, and people can't decide, is he a hero or a traitor, but we can say this without a doubt, that you and I can speak more knowledgeably as folks that don't have access to classified information about what the government is monitoring and what kinds of things are they doing. And you've probably heard about metadata collection. You remember a few months ago there was contention over this terrorist that had a phone and they wanted to get that hacked, and they were trying to force Apple Computer to put a backdoor in everybody's phone, and then they found a hacker that could just help them get in, and then that problem kind of went away. But the information that our government is collecting domestically about us in the United States is unprecedented. And according to many people, it goes beyond what the law would allow. There are things that the government could do internationally, but there's a lot of things they're doing domestically. So how about this? Have you heard anybody say this? I'm not a criminal. I'm not a terrorist. Why should I care about mass surveillance? Why should I care about privacy? And I think the answer to this question is perhaps one of the most important things that you and I can leave this room and this presentation with, an understanding of why it matters. And I'd summarize this in two basic ways. First of all, wow, I just pushed advance a lot more times than I needed to. The first thing that I would say, if somebody can kind of help me get my advance, because I think my remote, I'm going to go back to privacy matters. I got a little excited, I think. As you might, as you're talking about these topics. The first thing is that privacy matters. Privacy matters because we all have private lives that we are interested in not having broadcast around the world. I need to go back. I think one more. The second thing that we need to assume is that all the authorities are benign, or in other words, have our best interest at heart. Just because we live in the United States where we do have the Constitution and we do have the Declaration of Independence and we do have amendments and we have all these things and we have wonderful rights, that does not mean that the authorities that are in power are necessarily going to always have our best interests at heart. I've had a chance to travel to China and the Middle East, and there are many countries in the world that have different sets of values about how women are treated, what women are allowed to do, what you're allowed to wear. And they also have different ideas about the rights of citizens. And so for these two reasons, we really need to, I think, be advocates for privacy and advocates for our rights in this era of surveillance. And I'll try not to push the button too many times here. This last week, I read this article in the Los Angeles Times. Iran sentences another American, a 46-year-old from San Diego, to prison for, quote, collaborating with the United States. Well, he's a U.S. citizen. He just graduated from San Diego State University. And as he was visiting his family in Iran, they used posts that he had made to Facebook and social media as evidence of his collaboration with the United States. And he is now in prison in the nation of Iran. Now, this isn't just happening in other countries. We learned in October, prior to the election, that U.S. police officials used Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as a surveillance tool to arrest protesters in Baltimore. And so the information that we share, the access that we sometimes voluntarily provide, or maybe don't voluntarily provide, can be used by authorities for things that we may not know or intend. This article in The Intercept, Surveillance Self-Defense Against the Trump Administration, says, quote, thanks to 16 years of relentless and illegal expansion of executive power under Presidents Bush and Obama, Trump is about to have more tools of surveillance at his disposal than any tyrant ever has. Those preparing for the long fight ahead must protect themselves, even if doing so can be technically complicated. And there's some really good suggestions about things that you might want to do and consider if you're an activist, if you're someone who's trying to promote political change, or just if you're a citizen trying to protect your own privacy. So let's talk a little bit about corporate surveillance, because corporations like Amazon, like Google, like Microsoft even, Apple, are definitely gathering a lot of information. I am a teacher, so sometimes I give homework, and I hope it'll be okay, but I'm going to give you a homework assignment right now. And your homework assignment is to log into Google, if you have a Google account, and go to that website. Go to history.google.com. What you're going to find is a very comprehensive list of everything that you have shared with Google and the opportunity to delete it. And so I do love many of the Google tools, and they're so powerful. We use them at our school. And I also appreciate that Google makes this very visible. But this also might be alarming to you, because do you know if you use Google Maps, as I did today driving to Enid, and I said, Waller Middle School, not only is that information in a text form saved in a database, but my voice is saved on a server right here for Google to play and listen to. Everything that I put into Google is being recorded and saved. So, we need to make decisions about whether we're good with that or we want to make changes. How many of you participate in a rewards program somewhere? Okay, I do. And what does a rewards program ask you to do? What's your email address? What's your phone number? Why do they want your phone number? Some people are saying today that while the Social Security number has been so important and we know to protect that and not to put that online and share that, our phone number is every bit as important. because it's almost become our lifelong number that you're going to have forever. And if people have your phone number, and then they can connect the dots, they can do a lot of things. And these companies don't just want to market to us and say, hey, I know Wes likes Cheetos, maybe he wants to buy some now. They also want to sell that information to other companies. And there's billions of dollars being made today selling our information when we voluntarily give it away in many different ways. So the podcast Note to Self recently did a show about security and privacy and revealed that in 2011, 92% of children had an online presence by age 2. And of course, they weren't the ones choosing that. Their parents were choosing that. So another area of advocacy here is, what are we as adults deciding for our kids before they even have the ability to say yay or nay? I'm good with that. You know, I don't want that shared. One of the best projects I've seen about Facebook privacy is this one from ProPublica. It's called Breaking the Black Box. And in addition to these episodes that go into the ways in which information is being gathered and shared about us, they've created a free extension that's available for Google Chrome that allows you to get a little bit of a deeper dive into what kinds of things does Facebook know about you. I think Facebook today makes it a little bit more difficult to dive into those privacy settings, but you can do it. And I actually made a bunch of changes to my profile and the things that I have shared there as a result of reading this and using that extension. The recently published book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance, by Julia Arguin, also goes into many of these reasons of why this matters, we should care about it, and what we can do. So let's talk briefly about black hat hackers. I mentioned that there are two kinds of hacking. There's good hacking and there's bad hacking. How many of you have either been a victim of identity theft or you know someone who has? Okay? How many of you have had your email account hacked or you know someone who has? How many of you had a credit card or a debit card used without your authorization? See, the thing is, we're going to have more and more people saying yes to that because the cyber and the digital is just becoming more a part of our lives. But before we talk about that negative, let's talk about the positive. Because if you're a student sitting right now in this audience, our government needs you. We don't just need you to help protect our nation on land and on sea and in the air, as we traditionally, you know, do talk about, but it's also in the digital ether, in cyberspace. And Rose State College here in Oklahoma City just did a series of seminars for students this past summer, encouraging awareness about these skills and the jobs that are available in this area. Did you know we had an unprecedented cyber attack about 3 weeks ago on Friday? Did you notice your access to Netflix or to Twitter or some other big websites being interrupted? Well, Brian Krebs, who's a great researcher and writer on security issues, was one of the specific targets of this unprecedented cyber attack. And why was it so big? Well, it was because of the Internet of Things. See, as we put light bulbs and webcams and other devices, if our refrigerator is smart and it's connected to the Internet, it can be hacked. And so open tools are now available for hackers to use that can allow them to hijack those devices and engage in cyber attack. Incidentally, Brian's book, Spam Nation, is really a great one to look at. Ransomware is on the rise. What does that mean? It means you or I click a link, and then suddenly all the information and files on our computer is locked up, and that lockup could even spread to our network at our school or place of work. And until somebody pays a ransom with something like Bitcoin, that information is locked up. And hospitals and schools in the United States are the number one targets of ransomware today. So the other level of this, unfortunately, is an individual level. And if you're involved in custody battle or a divorce, or you have somebody who's angry with you, a simple Google search for spy on spouse phone will bring up a lot of tools that will allow people, if they can get you to click a link, to surreptitiously activate the microphone on your phone, activate the webcam, you know, be able to collect information about you without you even knowing. And before you cast me off the stage and say, Wes, you have gone too far, recognize that James Comey, before he made news talking about Hillary Clinton's email server before the election, made a lot of news when he said this. This is the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Everyone should cover up their laptop webcams right now. And he said that in September of 2016. So recognize that data can be weaponized. The hate that we saw in the election, directed towards journalists and directed towards others, can actually be directed towards any of us. And I think we need to be thoughtful as we decide what to share and how much to share. So, briefly, what do we do? Number one, get informed. Flipboard is a great tool that I use to find articles and share articles about digital security and surveillance. It's available for Android and for iOS. In addition, use a password manager. Use a different password on every website. I'm not the first person to tell you that, am I? Don't press the advanced key too often when you're giving a TEDx talk. And also, take on the responsibility of sharing this with others, because truly, like it or not, we live in a surveillance state, but we have responsibilities as well as rights in our country. And so the opportunity that we have to inform others and stay informed ourselves is probably the best step we can take in this situation. Thank you.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcast are independently produced by Wesley Fryer and are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Only license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.